Prior, a poem by the poet Matthew Prior. On little things, the sages write, depends our human joy or sorrow. If we don't catch a mouse tonight, alas, no eyebrows for tomorrow. Soon after, British Parliament passed a law declaring all women of whatever age, rank, profession, or degree, whether virgins, maids, or widows, that shall, from and after such act, impose upon, seduce, or betray into matrimony any of His Majesty's subjects, by the scents, paints, cosmetic washes, artificial teeth, false hair, Spanish wool, iron stays, hoops, high-heeled shoes, or bolstered hips, shall incur the penalty of the law in force against witchcraft, and their marriage, upon conviction, shall become null and void. On the bright side, in an era where a woman couldn't file for a divorce, I guess this was a fun way to get it done. Finally, in 1789, as the French Revolution was gearing up, the so-called Age of Enlightenment ushered in the novel idea of a fresh, healthy look. A new strict regimen of diet and exercise called on women to be beautiful without artifice. So suddenly, paint and powder were out. Though, actually, they weren't. But now women who wore them were accused of cheating. Welcome to the era of sneaky women. Still seeking poisonous makeup, but now arriving in closed carriages to make purchases of magnetic rock dew water of the Sahara for removing wrinkles, sold by charlatans like Madame Rachel, a famous swindler who demanded around $2,000 a bottle, which is what it would be adjusted for inflation. Apparently, the empowered Madame Rachel had bigger dreams for women than simple poisoning. So she also blackmailed her customers by threatening to expose them. After living through so much covert trauma, it only makes sense that when the French Revolution ended a few years later, fashionable women were chomping at the bit to openly start poisoning themselves again. They could hardly wait to try on that new red and white lead makeup that caused blindness, baldness, ruined tooth enamel, and, oh yes, also killed you. As luck would have it, before the pursuit of beauty eliminated the female gender in France completely, the Napoleonic Wars provided a tonic by temporarily cutting off supplies of both cosmetics and eligible bachelors. In came a romantic cult called Invalidism, causing the trendiest women to switch to a look that was languid, listless, and ghostly as they attempted to stage a version of the effects of consumption. By drinking vinegar and staying up late to increase their pallor and gain dark circles, they appeared to find comfort and purpose in pretend illness. So imagine what a happy day it was when these women discovered that they could achieve a seductively glazed look, complete with dilated pupils, by putting belladonna drops made from the deadly nightshade plant into their eyes, which also offered the more traditional delights of blindness, paralysis, vertigo, and headaches. Next thing you know, the Industrial Revolution had begun, and a new age of cosmetic manufacturing started in earnest. Finally, the savvy woman could realize her dream of buying her poison beauty supplies directly through her doctor, just like we do today. And before you could say slibber sauces, everyone was swallowing Fowler's solution, a great new complexion improver made from arsenic. Just the thing to help restless beauty seekers bide their time while they waited eagerly for today's numerous and far more unpronounceable modern-day poisons to finish being invented. I'm just curious, which of these looks do you think you would have played along with if you'd been born in another century?
Definitely the making yourself look ill one. I already have the dark circles, but I could perfect them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I think you could definitely perfect them.
Yeah.
I probably would have been putting a light coating of lead on myself, I'm horrified to say. A light coating, probably just enough to, you know, cripple me but not kill me.
Just a taste, almost a kiss of lead. Just the suggestion of lead.
That is probably what I go for. I've always liked pencils.
Subtle. Here's a question. How long do you have to strap a baby's head to a board in order to make it resemble an ear of corn? Asking for a friend here.
You don't have a baby you want to look like an ear of corn, I don't think, do you?
Not yet, but
maybe someday. Well, let's just say that a lot of the Mayan kids attended eighth grade graduation with boards still attached to their heads, which I think screwed up putting a mortarboard hat on. Really ruined the whole graduation kind of thing.
I mean, eighth graders are ugly enough as is.
Absolutely.
They could really only improve the aesthetics by adding the board.
They probably put cool graffiti on their boards.
To have a great summer on your board?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you sure it was Roman Senator Cato who said, because we have not kept our women individually under control, we now dread them collectively, and not Republican Senator Mitch McConnell?
I'm pretty sure our president would say that he alone is the one who thought of it first.
Did Elizabeth I die of lead poisoning, or was she just terminally pretty?
She actually was, I think, the perfect confluence of two really great trends. Terminally pretty and dead from lead. Dead from lead would have been a good name for a band.
Dead from lead sounds like a really good name for a really shitty band.
Good morning, girls. I'm going to talk to you this morning about the way you look. Now, I've heard it said that we women attach too much importance to our appearance. But that isn't true. After all, the way we look exerts so much influence on the way we feel and on the way other people feel about us that it really is very important.
People treat me differently when I look like shit. And by look like shit, I mean look how I actually look, without the benefit of cover-up and foundation and blush and mascara and pencil and lip liner and lipstick and powder and a 9th, 10th, 11th, or 20th form of war paint. If you've ever wondered how it feels to be invisible, try going clothes shopping in Los Angeles with your adult acne on display. You'll be the female George Bailey. Despite the fact that my job isn't predicated on me looking like a Kardashian, I can't help but feel insecure about my natural appearance. Hell, I shellacked my face this morning in order to drive to a studio and talk into a microphone. I often put makeup on when I have no plans to leave my house, which is most days. Have you been outside lately? It's terrifying. I am not a vain person. I am simply a pragmatic one. There's a cultural expectation for women to be, if not attractive, at least presentable, regardless of if it's our jobs to do so. Have you ever seen a woman who woke up like this speak in front of Congress? I rest my case. I, like many other women, use makeup in order to even the playing field, to game the system in order to be treated with more respect. By making ourselves appear more attractive, we exert power over the social disadvantage we have because we're women. Is it fair? No. Is it true? Yes. Because when you're a woman, aesthetics are agency. One recent study in which men and women were shown photos of the same women with and without makeup rated the made-up women as healthier and more confident than the ones without. They also declared the women in makeup had greater earning potential than those who were barefaced. Beauty is a commodity whose worth can be quantified. Studies have found that more attractive people earn higher salaries, are more likely to be hired and promoted, and even receive shorter prison sentences. When it comes to what constitutes female beauty, however, use of makeup is basically compulsory. A 2016 study of more than 14,000 people found that less attractive but more well-groomed, as in made up, women earned significantly more, on average, than attractive women who didn't make themselves up. In fact, grooming is what accounted for almost all salary differences, regardless of a woman's level of attractiveness. For men, naturally, the level of grooming hardly mattered. Want to get that raise, ladies? Don't lean in. Make up! Many women do, indeed, feel more confident when all dolled up. One 2017 survey by an online beauty retailer reported that over 50% of the 3,000 women polled said they, quote, don't feel confident making eye contact, end quote, without mascara, and that one in three wouldn't leave the house without foundation. A 2012 survey conducted by the Renfrew Center Foundation found that 44% of women had negative feelings of unattractiveness and uncomfortableness when they didn't wear makeup. Only 3% of women surveyed, presumably all of which have perfect bone structure and poreless skin, said going without makeup made them feel more attractive. Even if you're part of the envious, potentially insane 3%, it isn't illegal for your employer to tell you you have to wear makeup in order to keep your job. In the year 2000, Harrah's Casino in Reno, Nevada, instituted a policy that dictated female employees were required to have their hair, quote, teased, curled, or styled every day, and wear makeup, including foundation, mascara, blush, and lipstick, specifically selected by image consultants. Darlene Jepperson, a 20-year employee of the casino, complied with the hair requirement but refused to comply with a makeup one, as she found it offensive and proof that Harrah's, quote, sells and exploits its women employees, end quote. She was subsequently fired and sued Harrah's for gender discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, arguing that the policy imposed unequal burdens on women and required them to conform to gender stereotypes. The district court in Nevada ruled in Harrah's favor, as said policy also dictated that men were required to have short hair, so somehow the burdens imposed were equal? Because, you know, having to go to Supercuts once a month takes 10 fucking hours, what with the traffic in Reno and all. The case went to the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals, which agreed with the lesser court's decision. Chief Judge Schroeder, who inexplicably is a woman,
declared Jesperson had failed to produce any evidence regarding the cost of or time it takes to apply makeup. Something you'd think a woman would know, but maybe the judge blacks out every time she gets ready in the morning. And that the policy didn't constitute illegal gender stereotyping because Jesperson had failed to produce any evidence beyond her, quote, subjective reaction, end quote, that the policy was adopted based on a gender stereotype. But it doesn't take a mathematician to figure out that the policy does impose a burden on women that male employees don't have to bear. Even if you conservatively estimate it takes 20 minutes for female employees to do their hair and makeup, they'll spend 100 unpaid minutes every week complying with the policy. If they work 50 weeks a year, that ends up becoming over 2 weeks of, again, unpaid time they have to work in order to work. And 20 minutes, well, is a very conservative estimate. A 2014 study found that American women actually spend an average of 55 minutes every day focusing on their looks, declaring doing so makes them feel better about themselves. The same survey also found that adult women worry more regularly about their appearance than they do about finances, health, relationships, or professional success. And we haven't even gotten to the financial burden placed on women to be attractive. The global beauty industry is worth $382 billion, and research has revealed the average American woman will spend upwards of $250,000 on her appearance in her lifetime. Why are cosmetics so fucking expensive, you may ask? Because beauty products are marketed as solutions to problems. Age, acne, blotchiness, you name it. And women are willing to pay a pretty penny, pun sadly intended, to solve these problems. A quick browse through any women's magazine of the past or present will reveal pages upon pages of pricey products that claim to be innovations, backed up with pseudoscience. Yet there is very little to prove the efficacy of these new, innovative products, and magazine editorials rarely say anything negative about them since they make most of their money through the sale of advertisements. Products that are clinically tested are rarely done so by independent researchers. Rather, their testing is conducted by the manufacturers themselves. All it takes to make a product look legit is the presence of a person in a white lab coat and some impressive-sounding gibberish about technology. A combination of fake science and fake luxury is what sells in the prestige beauty industry, which, because of the increasing ubiquitous of retailers like Sephora and Ulta, and the popularity of contouring, a costly and time-consuming makeup technique that requires multiple products to pull off, is increasing in sales with each passing year. According to Euromonitor, a UK-based market intelligence firm, the average markup on premium cosmetics is 78%. The prestige beauty industry expensively packages inexpensive products in order to make them appear luxe. One study estimates that only 7 cents of a consumer's dollar goes to actual cosmetic ingredients. Speaking of, now's as good a time as any to talk about the ingredients that go into cosmetics. Times have changed since the Victorian era, where women ate arsenic, as in poison, in order to whiten their skin tones, remove their freckles, which were considered deformities at the time, with acid, and slathered their faces with lead. A 1915 public health report warned, "Of the many and varied abuses of drug products, there is none in which fraud, deception, and a wanton disregard for human health and even life are so clearly evidenced as in connection with the manufacture, sale, and use of so-called cosmetics, which routinely cause poisoning and palsy in many users." Yet today's cosmetics aren't as safe as you would assume. In fact, no safety testing at all is required for the industrial chemicals that go into personal care products. According to the FDA Office of Cosmetics and Colors, quote, "A cosmetic manufacturer may use almost any raw material as a cosmetic ingredient and market the product without an approval from the FDA," end quote. While the European Union has banned more than 1,000 ingredients from use in cosmetics, the FDA has, in the past 30 years, declared only 11 ingredients unsafe. With few exceptions, cosmetic companies may use any ingredient without governmental review or approval. The FDA also has no authority to require recalls of harmful cosmetics, nor are manufacturers required to report cosmetics-related injuries. Rather, the FDA relies on companies to voluntarily self-report. "Hey, if this face cream ends up causing, like, face cancer, can you let us know? Thanks in advance. Love you, mean it." According to Breast Cancer Prevention Partners, a science-based policy and advocacy organization, it is perfectly legal for companies to use ingredients linked to cancer, endocrine disruption, and reproductive harm in the cosmetics and personal care products we use every day. While cosmetics aren't regulated in the same way drugs are, since they're administered topically, they still penetrate the skin. As a result, scientists have found many common cosmetic ingredients in the human body, including parabens in breast tumor tissue, fragrance components in fat, and phthalates in urine. In May 2002, a group of environmental and public health organizations tested 72 name-brand beauty products for phthalates, which have been linked to permanent birth defects in the male reproductive system. They found them in nearly three-quarters of the products in question. Women of color, as if their lives aren't hard enough, are most susceptible to being exposed to dangerous beauty products. The EWG's 2016 analysis of almost 1,200 products marketed to black women found that 1 in 12 was, quote, highly hazardous, and less than 25% scored low in potentially hazardous ingredients, compared to 40% of items marketed to the general public. Sadly, women of color have a long history of being put in danger in order to conform to white standards of beauty. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, skin lightening became increasingly popular, as lighter-skinned black women were treated comparatively better than their darker-skinned counterparts. Advertisements extolled the virtues of lightening products, promising users that they'd occupy higher positions socially and commercially, marry better, get along better, and be more beautiful with lighter skin. Many of these creams contained hydroquinone, a chemical primarily used to develop film that had carcinogenic risks. Skin brightening, as it's now called, is still incredibly popular, practiced around the world and generating $10 billion in sales annually, even though many products still come with health risks like mercury poisoning. Women of color also lack representation when it comes to the expanding market of green, chemical-free makeup. The foundation shades for these emerging brands are extremely limited, as foundation options have consistently been ever since foundation began being mass-manufactured in the early 1920s. With 40 foundation shades, the darkest of which sold out first, it's no wonder Rihanna's Fenty Beauty line of makeup, which was launched last year, has been an enormous success. But sometimes makeup isn't enough. Sometimes you need to bring in the big guns. Sometimes you need cosmetic surgery. At the turn of the 20th century, the general public still generally believed that whether or not someone was truly beautiful, as in had classically attractive bone structure, was in God's hands. Reputable surgeons would never perform cosmetic procedures, as the idea of putting otherwise healthy patients at risk for the purpose of vanity lied in stark contrast to the Hippocratic oath to do no harm. The urbanization that occurred as a result of 20th century industrialization, however, made people want to take more control over their self-identities as they struggled to stand out in big, anonymous cities. Wanting and getting cosmetic surgery quickly became acceptable, an example of America's can-do, individualist attitude. What was once seen as vanity was now seen as strength, recognizing the problem that is your face and doing something about it. In 1924, the New York Daily Mirror held a competition to find the homeliest girl in New York, stating, "A plastic surgeon has offered to take the homeliest girl in the biggest city in the country and to make a beauty of her. Her misfortune may make a fortune right away." It's unknown if Rosa Travers, the sweatshop worker who won, ended up making a fortune right away. My money, however, is on no. She probably felt like $1 million, though, assuming the liquid paraffin injection she got in her breast didn't give her wax cancer. Public fascination with cosmetic surgery hit a high, or low, depending on how you view it, point a few years later. Dr. John Howard Crum, plastic surgeon and author of The Making of a Beautiful Face, or Facelifting Unveiled, performed the first public facelifting operation on record at the 1931 International Beauty Shop Owners Convention on a 60-year-old actress who felt she would be able to book more roles if some of her wrinkles were removed. 1,500 women attended the grotesque display, which a female reporter from The New Republic, Thyra Samter Winslow, said was a clear success, yet warned her readers about the potential that it could leave them, quote, more than a bit lopsided, or with a set expression, or entirely disfigured. But if you're getting on, she continued, and are beginning to be psychopathic about your appearance, regaining a semblance of youth may mean more to you than anything else in the world. And an operation including many injections of Novocaine, cutting, 50 stitches or so, $500 to $1,000, very real danger of infection, and the chance of being disfigured for life, may seem like a small price to pay for the possibility of looking younger again. Crum believed these risks were worth taking, declaring, "An aging and unattractive face will often have as disastrous an effect on a woman's life as some physical deformity, and that plastic surgery offered the one reliable method whereby time and age may be pushed back and the happiness of a woman advanced." Plastic surgery has since become big business. There were 15.9 million cosmetic procedures performed in the United States in 2015, a 2% increase over the previous year. Since 2000, overall procedures have risen 115%. While 92% of all cosmetic surgeries are performed on women, the doctors who perform them, like our good pal Crum, are overwhelmingly male, a whopping 85% as of 2017. Because who knows what's best for a woman than a man, am I right, ladies? The billion-dollar beauty industry continues to be a self-reinforcing cycle, demonstrating to women, its primary consumers, that their worth is tied up in their looks and liberation from self-loathing is just a cream or tuck away. That anti-wrinkle serum Vogue recommended didn't work? Just shove it in the back of the cabinet with the others. There's a newer, better innovation on the market anyway. While capitalism is, to be sure, a cancer, it infects women far more insidiously than it does men. Women are more likely than men to be emotional spenders, shopping when feeling lonely or depressed, and if there's one thing I know about being a woman, it's that the whole enchilada is pretty goddamn depressing. Women be shopping, cause women be sad! Have ever blankly stared into the glittering void of a Sephora display because I felt like shit? Has the president ever said it, quote, doesn't really matter what the press writes as long as you've got a young and beautiful piece of ass, end quote? Yes and yes. Which makes the words of Crumb just as dismally relevant now as they were 100 years ago. Face value is more than a mere phrase. It is a distinct asset and a moral obligation. You cannot afford to look anything less than the best. Your own success and happiness may depend on this factor more than you realize. Oh, I realize it. And yet still I'm unhappy. Funny that.
Listening to all this stuff that we both just researched, what do you think? Better or worse for women now?
I think it's kind of a wash in that we're still expected to do this shit in order to be treated like human beings. I mean, I guess it's better that we're not dying of lead poisoning.
Yeah, on the other hand, there's nobody controlling what goes in makeup, so we don't actually know. You know, we don't know if there's lead in what we're using now. We actually have no idea. Every time I buy a thing of mascara or any kind of base, it doesn't have an ingredient list on it.
Mm-mm.
So we have no idea whether or not we're dying of lead poisoning.
Actually, I hope I am because I don't have a retirement fund.
There is a list of 11 ingredients that are the only ones that you can't put in makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea what those 11 things are?
I mean, maybe toxic waste. I don't know. I didn't actually look at the list because I'm sure it's all, you know, scientific word gobbledygook.
I'm just guessing that. I wonder if, like, HPV virus, if you can put that in makeup.
You may as well. But everybody has HPV, Meryl. It's 2018.
What about salmonella?
Salmonella? Probably not. No.
No.
Yeah.
What about nerve gas?
It's a gas, so you can't put it in a cream. Dan, you're making my mind melt. What do you mean by gas?
Well, there's ingredients.
Molecularly, it's different.
Well, I thought maybe just the recipe for nerve gas, you could put that in a nice makeup base.
Or like solidified nerve gas.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, because, I mean, women inject their faces with botulism anyway.
That's right. That's why it's not that hard to imagine salmonella as being a good kind of a lip gloss.
Because what? It would also make you ill. And so by throwing up, you'd lose weight. Do you see where I'm going here?
It all seems logical to me. And if they don't have that, I'm just asking because I'm thinking you and I can jump in and manufacture the stuff.
Very easily.
In other words, what you learned is there's no safety testing at all required for industrial chemicals. Right? According to the FDA, quote, a cosmetic manufacturer may use almost any raw material as a cosmetic ingredient and market the product without an approval from the FDA. That's what you said, right?
Yes, correct.
I don't have a joke for that. I just wanted it to be said a second time. You know, we haven't discussed yet. You and I went a couple of weeks ago to this, the Ultimate Women's Expo, which was nothing if not. How would you sum it up in a few words?
Dismal, desperate marketing.
For?
Dismal, desperate women.
I was going to read you the list of notes I made when we were walking around the place and just see if you have any reactions to them, all right? Turmeric gummies without sugar.
I recall you liking the turmeric gummies
without
sugar.
No, you're recalling incorrectly. I hated the turmeric gummies.
You hated
gummies.
Them. Okay.
Yes. I hate gummies in general, and turmeric didn't make it any better.
You don't like being infantized?
Infantilized.
Infantilized. You don't like being infantilized?
Oh, that I like.
Oh.
Yeah. a lip color that doesn't kiss off.
You know what? I've been looking for that for 78 years. Still haven't found it.
I can't even keep lipstick on for like 15 minutes.
Same.
I put it on and think, all right, I just put it on a minute ago. Check the mirror. It's gone.
I think a woman who consistently has like a red lip is a witch. Do you know what I mean? Like those women where you never see it, just one molecule out of place.
I don't
perfect.
Understand how anybody keeps makeup on. In fact, I've had makeup artists tell me that I just absorb it into my skin the minute I put it on. I am a sponge for makeup, which must mean my internal organs are in really good shape.
Yes, your body is riddled with endocrine disablers or whatever.
But looking really cute.
I mean,
looking so cute with all that makeup on it.
Gorgeous.
Vivica Fox, we saw her speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was, what did she speak about? Can you remember
mostly
anything?
Her hair care line and how empowering it was to have one.
That was the big takeaway for me was the last time I went to one of these expos, it was all about self-care, about how you deserve it.
Yeah.
This time, all about empowerment.
Yeah.
Was totally co-opting feminism.
Well, the ultimate expression of femininity is using the 76 cents that you make to a man's dollar to buy hair.
Hair product, as they like to call it.
Extensions, yes.
Do you remember complimentary make and take workshops?
Was that when they had the cupcake decorating?
No, I think that was the wine glass.
Right,
where the woman, I used to teach art, and I've never seen an art teacher walk around telling people exactly how what they're supposed to do in terms of the painting, and then also telling them to really use their creativity.
Right,
it was a nice combination of just kind of mind blowing. What do you call it? Self-cancellation.
I think you call it a fun, flirty paradox, is what you call everything there.
A fun, flirty paradox?
A fun, flirty paradox.
Chapter 3, Sex.
In his last year with death near Hugh Hefner, his Bonnie's good money he'd pay. He'd swallow Viagra and come like Niagara when they put his diaper away. Putting the laundry away,
Welcome back to the indignities of being a woman.
You don't mean there are more indignities. Surely we've heard them all.
I don't think so. I mean, we still have a lot of chapters to go.
Well, what did we learn in that last one?
That before you read an audiobook, it's important to hydrate.
Okay, so what's up now?
Sex! Now that I have your attention, this chapter's about sex.
Well, there can't be any indignities there. You know that's going to be an improvement.
Yeah, I sense it will be. I mean, what could go wrong?
Everyone agrees that sex is an element that brings out sensible behavior in people. So you know what? I bet when we look into it, we're going to find a lot of carefully nuanced decision-making and consideration for others.
Sex is universal. I mean, everyone's always been having it, so when you think about it, how messed up could it really get? What's sex again?
Well, honey, when a man and a woman love each other very, very much...
Listen, we both know love has little to nothing to do with sex, all right? Also, points for being heteronormative. Jeez, it's 2018, Meryl.
Sorry. As any woman who's ever been part of a couple will tell you, the introduction of sex into what scientists call a pair bond instantly makes things more complicated. So human beings invented rules for coping. And oh, what rules these have been. Let's go back for a second to ancient Mesopotamia, where a baked clay image that somehow made the journey through time shows a man in 2000 BC having intercourse with a woman from behind. As he's pumping away, she's casually bent over drinking beer through a straw. That he doesn't even seem to notice indicates to me that perhaps the ancient Mesopotamians not too concerned about pleasing the ladies. Cut to 1,000 years after that, in 1150 BC in ancient Egypt, a culture that didn't produce much erotic art. Archaeologists find something called the Turin Erotic Papyrus, an 8.5-foot-long scroll consisting of 12 vignettes of markedly unattractive men, by which I mean scruffy, balding, unshaved, paunchy, and they have enormous penises. And all of these gnomes are having sex with picture-perfect females. Since no one seems clear about the explanation for this, I'm going to venture a guess that it's more women tolerating bad sex. Though I guess with its combination of geeky, weird, comedic men paired with gorgeous women, it could also be the pilot for the very first sitcom. By the 5th century BC, 1,500 years later, in the wonderful world of ancient classical Greece, marriage had become mandatory for all men. But here's a good idea. It was considered obscene for men to combine marriage and sexual desire. Meanwhile, for a woman to get married, she had to be a virgin and then faithful forever. So for her, it was a straight line from virginity to lifeless, dead-eyed monogamy. Women couldn't write, or at least their writing didn't survive, so we don't have first-person accounts of what this was like, but I'm going to take a wild guess here that one or two of these wives was kind of pissed off. Which is why ancient Greek marital sex, which was meant only for procreating, often turned out to be, guess what? Rape. A passage in a piece of Athenian writing describes a quote-unquote doorkeeper whose job it was to guard the bedroom door to keep the wife's friends from rushing in when they heard her scream. To be honest, I was kind of surprised that a Greek man even had time to work rape into his busy schedule when you consider what a full dance card he had, what with male and female prostitutes guaranteed to say yes, plus a house full of male and female slaves who wouldn't dare say no, plus the fact that pederasty, as in sex with young boys, was so common, it was the principal cultural model for free relationships between citizens. And by citizens, well, women weren't citizens. In other words, the average Greek husband rapist was extremely busy. So I guess it was damn nice of him to even let his wife have any friends. Meanwhile, over in India, roughly the same time period, about 600 BC, the Kama Sutra, the most famous sex book of all time, hit the stands. Known for its explicit list of sexual positions, it also offered some excellent advice about getting along with women. It gets off to a rousing start with, "An acceptable wife is a young girl who still hasn't completely hit puberty." That's an acceptable wife. Obviously, the ideal wife would have been younger. The writer then offers these sage directions to the parents of a daughter. When a girl becomes marriageable, her parents should dress her smartly, and having decorated her in a becoming manner, show her off to advantage in society, because she is a kind of merchandise. Maybe the entrepreneurial members of the PTA will all get together and have a half-off sale, who knows? And what happens, you wonder, if this prepubescent girl wasn't all that thrilled with the old guy who was stalking her? Well, then the Kama Sutra advises he should place her in his lap, and if she will not yield to him, he should frighten her by saying, "I shall impress marks of my teeth and nails on your lips and breasts, and then make similar marks on my own body, and I shall tell my friends that you did them. What will you say then?" In this and other ways, as fear and confidence are created in the minds of children, so should the man gain her over to his wishes. So romantic. Sadly, I guess she was too young for him to offer her a beer and a straw. But back in ancient Greece, I want to add that there were pockets of more progressive thought. For example, the Stoic philosophers from the 3rd century actively campaigned for equality of the sexes, which they felt were part of the laws of nature. Both Musonius and Seneca criticized the double standard, proving they were the ancient Greek versions of the hashtag not all men guys on Twitter. There were also the surprisingly sane cynics, who argued that men and women should wear the same clothing and receive the same kind of education, which all sounds pretty promising until you learn that the leader of this group, Diogenes, was a guy who slept in the marketplace in a large ceramic jar. But who am I to judge? It's probably nicer than my first apartment. Skipping merrily ahead to 700 BC and ancient Rome, this seems like an appropriate time to note that every entry in Wikipedia about women in ancient Rome begins with a version of this disclaimer. With extremely few exceptions, surviving Latin literature preserves the voices only of educated male Romans on the subject of sexuality. On the bright side, the Roman men who wrote history didn't totally rule out the possibility that monogamous marital sex might be enjoyable. Though they were careful to point out that married women knew better than to expect any pleasure or enjoyment from sex. Since they tied the knot simply to procreate, wives were instructed to remain completely still during intercourse, you know, in order not to, quote, misdirect the sowing of the seed. But in order to get to this blessed marital situation, a woman had to first undergo preliminary marriage rites involving Mutinous Teutonous, a phallic marriage deity who required the bride-to-be to straddle his, quote, awful phallus with its immense shameful parts. The idea was that through this ritual, innocent brides learned not to be embarrassed by sex, though it's far more likely what they learned was to be terrified of religion. On the other hand, yelling out Mutinous Teutonous may have been the last fun thing a girl got to do before the immobility of seed sowing engulfed her. Meanwhile, just like the ancient Greeks, the men of ancient Rome had plenty of other sex partners. In addition to male and female slaves and concubines, there were legal prostitutes of both sexes, many of whom were abandoned children purchased and raised to be prostitutes by large-scale prostitute farmers. What a perfect sex partner for a man whose kink was collapsing mid-orgasm into a never-ending sob about the bottomless tragedy of life on planet Earth. In ancient Rome, as in ancient Greece, it was considered completely normal for Roman men to have same-sex relations. Of course, there's almost nothing written about female homosexuality during this time. In fact, references to sex between women were so taboo in both ancient Rome and ancient Athens that even the famous first-century Roman love poet Ovid, a relatively progressive heterosexual who advocated lovemaking as a mutual pursuit, found the idea of two women together a desire known to no one. Freakish, novel. Among all animals, no female is seized by desire for female, because why would they be? Even animals have some standards. Also, on the topic of acceptable sexual positions, how about this brain teaser? Men on the passive end of a sex act were mocked and made to feel ashamed because they were said to be, quote, undergoing womanly things. However, if a man performed anal sex on a woman, she was mocked for playing the boy's role. I know, don't ask me. I guess this is the Roman version of contemplating infinity. Bringing us to the undiscussed idea of the ancient Roman man performing oral sex on a woman. Of course, totally out of the question, since the Romans felt it caused a toxic level of bad breath. Os impurum, or filthy mouth. Considering that the Romans cleaned their teeth with ground oyster shells, it's certainly possible that the blame for that bad breath was slightly misplaced. You know, you really have to stand in awe of the wealth of tremendous insights all the theoretically advanced ancients had into female sexual physiology. In the first century AD, Galen, the most prominent Greek medical expert, declared that there was really only one gender. Any guesses as to which one? That's right, men. Women were said to be identical physiologically to men, except, oh darn, women had everything in the wrong place. Take, for example, the female penis, which was said to be inverted because women were cold-blooded and therefore had too little of the necessary vital heat required to make the superior man penis become external. The reigning experts on anatomy gathered this impressive knowledge by dissecting dogs, pigs, monkeys, and male corpses. You know, because why mess around dissecting the inferior model of humans, i.e. women, when there were tons of perfectly good dogs and monkeys around to torture? Also, women's bodies were so tricky. They had this thing called the wandering uterus, which was like our regular uterus, only more of a rambler and a gambler a long way from home. The problem with the wandering uterus is not only did it not stay in one place, it was always filling up with that darn female semen, which, as you know, causes mental derangement. Our good friend Galen called this problem uterine fury. Among its symptoms were an itching in the genitals that made women touch themselves. A problem usually found in virgins, widows, and single women whose barren sex lives kept them from clearing out the toxic female uterus fumes. If all that wasn't enough, for centuries, the clitoris didn't exist. I mean, it did, but it was totally omitted from anatomical texts, since the Romans were sure it was an anomaly found only on freaks. The whole idea of the clitoris was so grotesque to them that the word they used for it, landica, was one of the most obscene words in the Latin lexicon. By the way, store that for next time you go to Italy. By the 1300s, the horror of the clitoris had grown to such an extent that priests in the Catholic Inquisition believed women in the throes of lust could enlarge their clitorises and literally transform themselves into men. With the important caveat, as noted by famous physician Paul Zakia of the 1400s, women can turn into men, but men cannot turn into women, because nature always tends toward the more perfect. It wasn't until 100 years later, in 1545, that a few French doctors, including one named Charles Estienne, finally decided to identify the clitoris based on dissecting a female corpse. And since they could no longer deny it existed, they concluded it had a urinary function. After Vesalius, who's known as the founder of modern anatomy, read about this, here's what he said. You can hardly ascribe this new and useless part as if it were an organ to healthy women. I think that such a structure appears in hermaphrodites who otherwise have well-formed genitals, but I have never once seen in any woman even the rudiments of a tiny phallus. Vesalius went on to do anatomical drawings of vessels he believed ran between the vagina and the breasts because he also believed that menstrual blood eventually became milk, making the Vesalius house the place none of the kids ever wanted to go for an after-school snack. Not surprisingly, during this same time, clitoridectomies became popular. As a way to get rid of this pointless body part, probably before Vesalius did more drawings and tried to prove it also produced milk. It wasn't until the late 16th century that doctors began recognizing the clitoris as a normal part of female anatomy, And not until the 19th century that a German anatomist named Kobelt finally had the good sense to sigh and comment with what I hope was sarcastic understatement. We are extremely surprised that some anatomists make no more mention of this than if it did not exist at all, since in every cadaver we have so far dissected, we have found it to be quite perceptible to sight and touch. But even without an official clitoris, it was a world of sex fun for the ladies of feudal Europe. Back then, it was commonly believed that women were sexually insatiable. Therefore, it was just smart, sensible employee multitasking to require your female domestic servant to deflower your sons and become active concubine of the man of the house in her free time. Luckily, the Protestant Reformation of the 1500s was right around the corner, bringing Martin Luther and his uplifting message that sex was pleasing to God. Well, sex for men. Since Martin Luther, who really liked to sweet-talk the ladies, also said, "Let them bear children until they are dead. That is what they are for." What a perfect sentiment to embroider on a quilt for a baby shower. One thing the 16th century excelled at was creativity in vaginal nicknames. There were dozens to choose from. For instance, pudding, beef, mawkin, poop, bugglebow, whim-wham, Cecily bum trinket, Watergate, Trump Tower Moscow. I'm just kidding about Trump Tower, but Watergate was a real one. The 17th century also offered some good ones. For example, Fuzzy Wuzzy, Flap Doodle, Crinkum Crankum, Jiggum Bob, Turly Whirly, and Spunk Box. This was more practical than it would seem, since it turns out the female sex organs didn't even have any official names until the 18th century, because, don't forget, they were still thought to be an inverted penis. Had I been alive then, I would have gone door-to-door advocating for Crinkum Crankum, which I think would have been more fun to say than vagina. Also a pretty big waste of my time, since women couldn't vote for another 325 years. But much the way a broken clock is right twice a day, the long, rich historical tradition of bad ideas about women and sex at one point worked ever so briefly in women's favor. For a large chunk of Western history, doctors believed a woman could only get pregnant when both the man and the woman experienced orgasm. It was considered a basic law of nature and written into many handbooks for midwives, all the way up till the Renaissance. This being the Middle Ages, of course, there was a teensy downside to this theory, because it also meant that if a woman was raped and got pregnant, she had apparently enjoyed herself. Technically, that meant it wasn't a rape after all. St. Augustine called this the sin of involuntary pleasure. Just the additional headache women were needing. Unfortunately, the good times did not last. Around 1730, anatomists ruined everything when they proved that the female orgasm was not essential for reproduction and not important to women's happiness in general, which was just as well since major Enlightenment thinkers of the period, such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Charles Montesquieu, thought female passion was a cage you'd best not rattle. Passionate women were bad for social stability. The upshot was, so many respectable young men just gave up and resorted to using prostitutes that in 1791, it was estimated there were 50,000 prostitutes in London. Another fun fact, the word prostitute referred not only to women who sold their bodies for sex, but also women who had relations with men for pleasure rather than money. At least half of this figure consisted of unmarried women living with a partner, otherwise known as whores, in case you were wondering how Meghan and I would have fared at the turn of the 17th century. Saddest of all, this was 400 years before the invention of the ironic T-shirt. By the Victorian era, 100 years later, doctors had seen the error of their ways and realized that the truth about female sexuality was 180 degrees in the other direction. Now they decided it was men who were the lustful creatures. Women were angelic creatures who, as a bonus, had no sexual desire at all. So not only were women not insatiable, now experts believed they were not even able to have a true orgasm. As a general rule, said the English urologist William Acton in 1875, a modest woman seldom desires any gratification for herself. She submits to her husband's embraces, principally to gratify him, and were it not for the desire of maternity, would far rather be relieved of his attentions. Way to rationalize your miserable, boring marriage, Dr. Acton. Of course, in the face of these new harsh truths, male experts agreed that it was still of great importance for this asexual wife to serve her husband sexually. So, French medical expert Dr. Auguste Debay wrote a best-selling marriage manual in which he gave his puzzled female readership this recommendation. Oh, wives, follow this advice. Submit to your husband's needs. Force yourself to put on an act and simulate the spasm of pleasure. This innocent deception is permitted when it's a question of keeping a husband. In other words, I think we have found ground zero in the annals of faking an orgasm. Though considering everything else women had been through, it's a surprise that some church or legal committee didn't immediately start arresting women for sex fraud. Probably just an oversight. Anyway, the upshot was that now that orgasms were impossible for women to have, men were finally off the hook for even trying to please women. So hooray! Now they could return to a more relaxing and preferable form of sexual intercourse, popularly known as not giving a shit. Sales of beer and straws probably skyrocketed. And all of this eventually leading up to the writing of the quintessential 20th century joke. Tell me if you've heard this one, Megan. Why do women fake orgasm? Because they think men care.
That's charming.
Isn't that?
I mean, it's a charming collection of facts. Don't you think that that clay image in Mesopotamia where the guy's making it with the woman who's drinking a beer through a straw was just commentary on how alcohol makes mediocre sex more tolerable, though?
Well, it also can, I guess, provide welcome distraction to the flavor of really cheap beer. I mean, God only knows what they were making beer out of in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, I'm excited. I was worried we'd be able to get through a chapter without marital rape popping up again. So I'm glad that the fellows in ancient classical Greece found it as acceptable as, the current president of the United States of America.
I think we're going to be hearing about marital rape in every chapter in this book.
Oh, my prayer candle worked. Fantastic. Yeah, I'm also glad they eventually abandoned the idea that female orgasms are necessary for procreation, because if that were the case, I don't think you or I would exist.
You only say that because you never met my parents. They were the kind of sexual acrobats that they just don't make them anymore. Our living room sofa was a trapeze.
That's far more loving than the environment that I grew up in.
I wish we had known each other then. You would have so enjoyed my parents.
We're seeing an explosion of sexual expression. Again, not just necessarily the in-bed expression, but in all of our communications media, for instance. And in all of our waking thoughts, waking music, and our waking reading, there's this tremendous explosion of almost obsession with sex, the genital aspects of sex.
Despite the fact that I'm a millennial, I'm hashtag blessed in that I have found a sexual partner who doesn't require shoving a woman's head into a toilet in order to get an erection, which is depressingly more common than you'd think nowadays. If I had a dollar for every time a man has fucked me in a manner that implies punishment, I'd be able to finance my startup idea for a vibrator so sensitive it cuddles you to sleep after your third orgasm. Sorry, men's rights activists who are listening to this right now so you can make a reaction video on YouTube. You're right, I am being uptight. I should like being hate-fucked by someone I love. Hell, I should be grateful I'm even allowed to have sex with someone I'm not married to without being imprisoned. Not to mention the fact that I'm allowed to even think, let alone speak, about sex in the first place. Were I a woman in the Victorian era, I'd be expected to do the impossible, possess zero sex drive. Now, don't let the fact that women's underwear was crotchless at the time fool you into thinking it was because everyone was a horn dog. It was only so ladies could pee without having to pull it down, which would have been impossible given how much fabric and steel, yes, steel, their dresses were literally cages, surrounded them. It was, in fact, popular to diagnose women who masturbated with hysteria, a disorder that required clitoral stimulation in a doctor's office. The vibrator was ultimately invented in the 1880s to save doctors the trouble of having to induce paroxysm, aka orgasms, manually. In extreme cases of hysteria, women were institutionalized or given clitorectomies. The English gynecologist Isaac Baker Brown, who believed women afflicted with hysteria were on a fast track to death, made a name for himself as the inventor of medical clitorectomies in his book On the Curability of Certain Forms of Insanity, Epilepsy, Catalepsy, and Hysteria in Females, which influenced American gynecologists into using his technique, complete removal of the clitoris with scissors, packing the wound with lint, and administering opium via the anus, in the treatment of masturbation, nymphomania, and hysteria for years to come. A New Orleans-based surgeon in 1894 reported that he'd successfully removed the clitoris of a 2.5-year-old girl, noting that afterwards she had, quote, grown stouter, more playful, and had ceased masturbating entirely. Got your clit is a way less fun children's game than got your nose. Young women were supposed to remain entirely chaste until marriage, and their far too proper mothers certainly didn't tell them anything about what awaited them once a ring was put on it. An 1895 advice book called The Doctor's Plain Talk to Young Men warned that,
On their wedding night, their bride's, quote, mind and habits have been so pure and free from lust that there has never been anything to produce an excitement of the sexual passions. She may be indifferent regarding intercourse, and she may look upon it with horror. Horrified or not, laying down and getting shtupped was a woman's duty. I say laying down because, according to Dr. James Aston, author of the succinctly titled 1861 book, The Book of Nature, containing information for young people who think of getting married on the philosophy of procreation and sexual intercourse, semicolon, showing how to prevent conception and to avoid childbearing period, also, comma, rules for management during labor and childbirth, it was imperative to always make whoopee in the missionary position, since unnatural positions will cause derangements and bearing down of the womb, and sometimes will originate tumors and fungi in the private parts. A woman of delicate mold and constitution might be fatally injured in this manner. The same book declared married women are seldom troubled with sexual desires, but once a man has gained the love of a true female heart, it lies in his power to use her person at will. And by her person, I mean her vagina, a curved tube that possesses some curious powers, which are in action only during connection with the male. Sadly, one of its curious powers wasn't the ability to stop marital rape. Oh, and speaking of marital rape, it wasn't outlawed in all 50 states until 1993. And prior to the mid-70s, it was exempted from ordinary rape laws altogether. As a matter of fact, in the 19th century, state laws around the U.S. defined rape as the carnal knowledge of a woman when achieved by force by a man other than her husband. Now, doesn't that just make you want to lay down in a dark room and not get shtupped by yours? Now, let's say you made the critical error of engaging in desired intercourse with someone who was not your husband at the end of the 19th century. If you did so and didn't immediately marry the lucky chap, or he ended up ditching you, you were considered ruined, regardless of if the coupling resulted in a pregnancy. The intense social stigma that surrounded premarital sex, combined with economic necessity, made a lot of ruined women take the step into prostitution. Pimping indeed ain't easy, but you want to know what's harder? Being pimped. During the pioneer days of the American West, many women who found themselves without means or marriage ended up joining the sisterhood. Most ended up destitute, riddled with disease, and addicted to drugs. While high-end brothels did exist, the majority of women worked in common ones. There, a girl could see as many as 60 men per shift and receive as little as 25 cents per encounter, which, adjusted for inflation, is still dreadful. For the price of a tuna sandwich, a lifetime of disease and shame, you can't argue with that value. These fallen women forfeited most of their rights and all of their respect when they became prostitutes.
Decent women were afforded protection.
Abuse of women in any form was a hangable offense in those days, yet beaten, raped, and abused prostitutes were seen as getting what they deserved. And who had the least rights of all? Chinese sex workers. At one time, 90% of Chinese women in America were prostitutes, and almost 90% of them were physically forced into doing so.
In impoverished 19th century China, female children were considered liabilities, sold to sex traffickers for $20 to $100. They were then resold in America for 2 to 5 times that.
San Francisco's Chinatown had a bustling girl auction scene, with the SF Chronicle reporting in 1869 that the particularly fine portions of the cargo, the fresh and pretty females who came from the interior, are used to fill special orders from wealthy merchants and prosperous tradesmen. A very considerable portion are sent in answer to demands from well-to-do miners and successful vegetable producers. If you're wondering how this could possibly be legal, allow me to explain. Once the bidding was over, the money from the winning bidder was placed in the sold woman's hand, who then placed it in the hand of the person who sold her and signed a contract stating she had taken the money freely and agreed to do whatever the buyer desired of her. Many women still in China signed contracts of indentured servitude riddled with numerous clauses they could never fulfill in exchange for passage to the United States. While not technically a slave, almost every contract had a clause stating that, if she escaped, she'd be liable for the cost of her capture plus the revenue her pimp lost while she was on the run. Even when they became too old to be used for sex, their contracts were still valid. Many served the rest of their lives as maids, cooks, or laundresses. Some were sold to farmers for $50 to $75 and worked the fields until they died. In the early 20th century, almost every American city had an active prostitution trade, and America's soldiers were big fans. In brothels, venereal disease was the rule, not the exception, and soldiers were losing the war against VD. More were hospitalized for it than for battle-related illnesses. When the Selective Service found that almost 15% of men eligible for the draft already had a venereal disease, they went into full-on crisis mode. Local governments, seeing prostitutes and not the behavior of America's servicemen as the problem, began shutting down red light districts. And in 1918, Congress passed the Chamberlain-Kahn Act, which gave police the power to forcibly detain, examine, and quarantine any woman suspected of having VD, as evidence thereof was proof of her being a prostitute. Any woman spotted near a military base without a male escort could be seen as suspect, arrested, and subjected to a gynecological exam, which she may have, due to poor sanitary conditions, actually received VD from. If she were infected, she was quarantined, usually for a few months, but minors were detained for longer, sometimes years. In all, 30,000 women were involuntarily locked up. Did the whole ordeal make less soldiers get VD? What do you think? Thinking anything but no is incorrect, by the way. Even if you weren't caught loitering around an Air Force base with your tits hanging out of your bullet bra, being seen as a good time gal during World War II might still subject you to arrest, as moral code solely condemned women for sexual promiscuity. Arrests for prostitution and/or solicitation only rose by about 20% during the war, yet arrests for disorderly conduct rose by over 200%. Tens of thousands of women were picked up for the mere suspicion of being promiscuous, held without charges, and physically examined for disease. The likelihood of a woman being picked up was higher if she were poor, a minority, or young. Any teen girl police declared was, quote, in danger of falling into vice, could be apprehended. Which is not to say women didn't engage in premarital sex. Alfred Kinsey's groundbreaking 1953 report on American sexuality found that half of the women he surveyed had done so. Most, however, slept with the men they believed would become their future husbands. Lack of access to reliable contraception and fear of unwanted pregnancy is what probably kept many women from engaging in sex before marriage. A fear that changed, eventually, once the pill came along. The pill was made legal in 1960. Just because it existed, however, didn't mean it was easy to obtain. In the year of its release, 30 states had laws restricting the sale or advertising of anything related to birth control. The worst was in Connecticut, where anyone convicted of using, buying, or helping someone acquire it could be fined or sentenced to a year in prison. Planned Parenthood ran a van service across state lines to clinics in Rhode Island and New York, but not Massachusetts. The law there banned anyone, even doctors, from helping women get contraceptives. The Supreme Court ultimately declared the Connecticut law unconstitutional in 1965 on the basis that it violated married couples' constitutional rights. In 72, the court declared Massachusetts law unconstitutional as well, making birth control accessible to everyone, not just married couples. Abortion was illegal everywhere until the late 60s. Women who were unmarried and didn't want kids were sent to homes for unwed mothers, where they gave birth and subsequently put their babies up for adoption, or risked their lives getting unsanitary and unregulated back-alley abortions. In 1967, Colorado became the first state to decriminalize abortion in cases of rape or incest. After Roe v. Wade in 1973, it became fully legal everywhere. And still is, for now. Get back to me once the Trump administration is done trying to make The Handmaid's Tale a reality. In the 60s, you no longer needed a husband or the prospect of one to get laid. The cover of Helen Gurley Brown's best-selling book, Sex and the Single Girl, published in 1962, claimed it, quote, torpedoed the myth that a girl must be married to enjoy a satisfying life. With the pill and abortion legal, and no real fear yet of STDs, women were able to bawl with abandon, if only they really enjoyed it. The publication of the Height Report, a nationwide study of female sexuality in 1976, showed how, while ostensibly liberated, women were still sexual second-class citizens. It debunked one of female sexuality's greatest myths, that most women could orgasm as a result of penetration. The report found only 30% of the 3,000 women surveyed regularly orgasmed as a result of heterosexual intercourse. 95% of women who masturbated, however, did. According to the report's author,
Cher Height,
the fact is that the role of women in sex, as in every other aspect of life, has been to serve the needs of others, men and children. And just as women did not recognize their oppression in a general sense until recently, just so sexual slavery has been an almost unconscious way of life for most women. Women are sexual slaves insofar as they are justifiably afraid to come out with their own sexuality and forced to satisfy others' needs and ignore their own. Many women are still afraid to come out and demand their nut. According to Peggy Orenstein's fascinating book about the sex lives of young adults, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, today 75% of men report regularly climaxing during sex, while only 29% of women say the same. Girls are four times more willing than boys to engage in sexual activity they don't want or like, particularly oral and anal, and an expansive 2013 research study called The Sex Lives of College Students found that the number of girls who fake orgasms has risen from less than half in 1990 to 70% today. The myth of sexual liberation was that it was a good thing for women, when, in actuality, it kind of made it easier for us to be used by guys. The sexual revolution put the onus on women to enjoy it, or at least pretend to, or else. If you didn't, you were uptight, a prude, in much the same way you're a prude if you don't approve of the proliferation of pornography in the modern age. In the mid-century, a number of Supreme Court decisions making print pornography legal led to the rise of nudie mags and sex films. With the advent of the internet, it's become easier than ever to view pornography. A recent study published in the academic journal Pediatrics found that over 40% of kids between the ages of 10 and 17 had seen porn online. In a country in which half the states don't mandate sex education in schools and abstinence-only education is on the rise, porn fills the hole, pun sadly intended, created by this lack of education. Most women in the 50s and 60s didn't even give blowjobs. Now, more